A wealthy farmer had the best harvest of his life. His fields produced so much wheat and barley, and his orchards produced so many grapes and olives that he did not have room for them all. With great delight, he thought through his problem and finally decided that he was going to go pull down his barns, build bigger ones where he could store all of his crops. He went to bed that night content. He had enough now to take it easy for the rest of his life, and before he had drifted off to sleep, he thought, I have enough stored up to last me until I die. I will take it easy, eat, drink, and rejoice. But that rich man failed to consider God in his planning. That night, God said to him, you fool, tonight you will die. Now who's going to enjoy all your treasure? It's a powerful parable. With this particular parable, Jesus begins a longer teaching about a right relationship to our stuff. And the parable is a bit surprising because the rich man's decisions, at least on the surface, are sound. From a financial standpoint, he made good decisions, but God condemned him. Why? Well, let's read the passage and see if we can find the answer. Luke 12, verse 13. Then one from the crowd said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. But he said to him, Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you? And he said to them, Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, The ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops? So he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So Jesus teaches this parable in response to a question. A man in the crowd wanted Jesus to solve a dispute between him and his brother about their inheritance. Now, no information is given about the dispute except the one making the request did not believe he was getting his fair share. So he wanted Jesus to be the arbitrator and decide in favor of him. Don't miss that from the text. He doesn't say decide between us. He says, here's the decision I want you to make for me. And Jesus responds to him in a way that surprises me. Because Jesus refused, and he refused by asking the man who gave Jesus the responsibility to settle such matters. Now, as the Son of God, who knows all things, who is sovereign over all the world, he absolutely has the authority to settle such questions. He has all of the knowledge necessary to settle the matter with perfect justice. But what Jesus does is refuse to discuss the case. Instead, he ignored the surface request. And he spoke to this man and spoke to the crowds much as he spoke to Nicodemus. He ignored the surface and spoke to the heart issue instead. And so Jesus answers this man in verse 15 by saying to them. He speaks to the entire crowd. So the man, he's answering the man. But he's answering the man in such a way that all can hear him and for the benefit of all of them. And he warns them to watch out for and be on guard against covetousness. So what Jesus is saying is the strife between these two brothers was caused by a greedy, sinful desire for more. In 1 Corinthians 6, verse 7, Paul says that it is better to allow yourself to be defrauded than to take your Christian brother to court, than to sue a fellow believer. That seems to be the same basic idea that Jesus is operating under here. The brothers are arguing over this inheritance because of covetousness. So the one who has apparently kept more than he should have is greedily hanging on to what doesn't belong him. The one who is contending with him appears to be more worried about getting something than he is about the relationship between him and his brother. He has emphasized belongings over the relationship. And then Jesus makes a crucial statement. It's second half of verse 15. This is one of those vital statements that as you as a Christian think about living the Christian life, this is one of these things we need plastered in the front of our minds. Because Jesus says, one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. What Jesus does in that statement is he denies the central lie of covetousness. Because greed and covetousness thinks that life is measured by how much you have. Jesus says that's not how life is measured at all. And to prove his point, he told this parable of the rich farmer. And so we find this man with incredibly fertile fields, which produced in 1 year enough for him to live comfortably for many years. So much he did not have enough room to store the harvest. The crop was so great that he could afford to tear down his old barns, build new ones, and then live off the net profits for the rest of his life. So that's what he determined to do. Now, notice, this man's not done anything wrong. As part of the surprise in this parable, that this parable does not imply this man got rich by cheating others, by refusing to pay his field hands. His riches were gained properly. He planted fields. He worked hard, apparently. He planned well, and he reaped an abundant harvest. So the crowd who first heard Jesus tell this parable would have assumed, and rightly so, that God gave this man a good harvest. There's no way that this rich man forced his crops to grow in abundance. Rather, God blessed the man's fields with sun and rain and the proper nourishment so that it could produce this remarkable crop. And the man's plans to build bigger storage barns are not bad plans. They certainly are what any good farmer in that situation would do. He wasn't cheating others by building bigger barns. He wasn't stealing from others to fill his barns. He really was making good plans to store up his possessions so that he would have sufficient provision for the years to come. And in fact, you can argue that this man is acting in accord with the wisdom of Proverbs. Because Proverbs 27 teaches that the wise person will prepare for the future. He will make plans in the context of Proverbs 27. He will care for his livestock. He will invest well in his farm so that in the days ahead, he will have provision for his needs and the needs of his own household. And the rich man in this parable, he's doing that. He's planning and storing up for the days to come. He's planning a secure future. And his outward actions are not wrong. I don't think we can read into the externals of what he did anything sinful. After setting everything to his satisfaction, he was content. He had good plans, and he knew that he would be set up for life. And so he looked ahead to the day when all of his plans were completed. And then he would be able to prop his feet up. And he said to himself four words: rest, eat, drink, rejoice. That was his plan. That's what he was looking forward to. And again, you can argue that even that has some biblical roots. Because if you go back to the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 8, verse 15, it says, a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. For this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life. I mean, it's almost exactly what this guy said. Eat, drink, and rejoice. Eat, drink, and be merry. Surely if the wisest man who ever lived said that this was a good thing to do, then what's wrong with this guy doing it? Except that actually doesn't understand Ecclesiastes rightly. I won't go back and walk through Ecclesiastes this morning. But the point that Solomon is making is that this is an incomplete answer. As far as it goes, it's okay. But it doesn't go far enough. And that's where the problem lies. And that's the problem with this man. Because certainly from a human perspective, everything he did was proper. He was not a great criminal. He was not an evil man because he was rich. Now, I know there are some in America who want to make villains out of every rich person. But the Bible never teaches that having wealth is sinful. The rich farmer was blessed by a superabundant harvest, and then he planned well. Yet God called him a fool. Why? Well, the answer is in verse 20. God makes one statement, and then he asks one question. God's statement is full. This night, your soul will be required of you. Now, if you've heard others preach on this parable, you probably have heard them emphasize the fact of the sudden death of this man. That this one has, he did not consider the inescapable reality of death. And certainly, one who does not look at the end, does not recognize that death is coming for all of us, that one is foolish. Again, you go back to Ecclesiastes, and in fact, it tells us that it's better to dwell in the house of mourning than in the house of feasting, because mourning, the grave, will be the end of all of us. It is wise to consider the end, and this man was foolish for not considering that his life could end at any moment. And in fact, none of us are assured of tomorrow. We should recognize that. We should live conscious of the fact. James chapter 5 teaches Christians to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. I'm sorry, that's James 4, not James 5. The point is, if the Lord wills, then we will. And that statement, though, that Jesus makes, your soul will be required, is more than a foretelling of death. The word that he uses there that's translated required is speaking of requiring something back again. So if I loan you my ink pen, I give it to you and you can keep it for however long you need it, but I come and I require it from you. I'm asking you to give me back. I'm taking back what belongs to me. That's the word Jesus uses. That's the idea of what Jesus is saying here. He's not saying your death is going to be sudden, but rather you are going to be called back to God, if you will. He's communicating that one's soul is not his own. That's what Jesus is saying. Again, Ecclesiastes says exactly this. It says in chapter 12, then the dust will return to the earth as it was. Speaking of physical death. When we are buried, our body is placed in the ground and we know that it rots away and eventually corrupts into dirt. Adam was created out of the dirt of the ground in the Garden of Eden. And at death, that's what we go back to. And then Ecclesiastes goes on to say, the spirit will return to God who gave it. So death is not just the end of life on this earth. Death is also the return of the soul to its creator. Now I should mention, This return is not at all like that described by Buddhism and other Asian or Far East religions there. The soul does not return to God to be absorbed into Him and to lose all personal identity. The Bible teaches very, very plainly that after death, the soul continues to exist. Your soul will continue to exist. You do not lose your identity, but you remain distinct. You're separate from God and separate from all other creatures. You remain you, but you return to God who created you. And implied in this, and certainly in the parable, Jesus is pointing to that in this return, there is an accountability. There is an answering for how one uses the life given. So that when you die, you return to God and you will give account to Him for how you have used the life He gave you. And this man is a fool because he planned the remainder of his life without considering that his life is not his own to spend how he wants. He was a fool because he did not consider he would be held accountable by the one who gave him life. He was a fool because God was not in his plan. And so God made a statement, "Fool, this night your soul will be required of you." He also asked a question, "Then whose will those things be which you have provided?" This rich man had done all the work and made all his necessary preparations. He had all these grand plans. But for whom did he do the work? Who was going to get all that he had labored to store up? Once again, Ecclesiastes helps us think through this. Because Ecclesiastes tells us that we don't know what's going to happen to our stuff when we're gone. It specifically says, we don't know, man does not know if his heirs will be foolish or wise. You don't know if your kids are going to take everything and throw it in the dumpster. Or give it to Goodwill. If they're going to use it, if they're going to misuse it, they're not going to care about it, they're going to let it sit in a storage room and rot, who knows what's going to happen to it? Now, this doesn't mean a Christian should plan not to leave anything to his children. In fact, Proverbs says a good man leaves an inheritance for his grandchildren. He's looking two generations ahead. The point of this parable is not go spend it all now because your kids are probably going to waste it anyway. That's not what Christ is saying. God, he's pointing out the futility of this rich man's planning. Whose will all these things be? The answer is not his. Who knows who's going to get them, but you're not. That's what God is telling this man. He planned. He planned carefully, but his planning was ultimately short-sighted. And as a result, he would not enjoy any of his goods. And then Jesus makes the point. Verse 21 is where all of this is going. So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. What Jesus is saying, he's telling everyone listening, he's telling us that the one who labors for himself and for the possessions of this world will be like that rich fool. The one whose concern is for his own ease, who stores up his treasures that he may be comfortable, he will be like this rich fool. Ultimately, he will not enjoy that which he has labored to gain. The covetous one, the one who always needs a little more, is ultimately a fool who will lose everything he values. And in this parable and this discourse, Jesus reveals the lies of covetousness. In this, he points out to us what greed tells us. He identifies ultimately three desires that covetousness seeks to fulfill but cannot fulfill. Now, Colossians 3, verse 5 says that covetousness is idolatry. And this is true in part because covetousness trusts a created thing to be the ultimate source of what only God can give. So what Jesus says here in this parable is that covetousness seeks identity, peace, and joy in possessions. Covetousness looks to the stuff to try to get ultimate meaning and satisfaction. And there is no created thing that can give that. There is no created person who can give that. Ultimately, those things come from God and are found in Him. So that identity, peace, and joy do not depend upon possessions. If you doubt this, if you're wondering if that's really true, look at the persecuted church around the world. Go read the Voice of the Martyrs magazine. Go ask the persecuted church if they need stuff, if they need a storage unit full to have an identity. Go ask the persecuted church if they need their own home to have peace. Go ask the persecuted church if they need the latest iPhone to have joy. I hope you recognize those are rhetorical questions. Covetousness comes and lies all the time. It lies promising that it will make you somebody. Greed looks to possessions to give you identity. In verse 15 again, Jesus points out that greed defines life based on what one owns. Life is better if you have more. Those who don't have a worse life, and they're to be pitied. That's the lie of covetousness. Does that sound at all familiar? That echoes around us in our culture. Covetousness whispers to you that if you will have a little bit more or the latest of whatever your particular favorite things are, then your life will be good. Greed says that what your life really lacks is stuff. You need more things. And so the way to be fulfilled is by buying something else. Now, this is most obvious in those who binge shop to make themselves feel better. So they're down, they've had a little bit of a bad day, they get on the internet and they spend hundreds of dollars in an evening because they're feeling bad. And it makes them feel better. That's the lie of greed. That your life revolves around what you have. And this is also true of those who just have to have the latest edition of something. So if you are unhappy, if you don't have the latest version of the phone, if you are unhappy, if you cannot trade in your car every 3 years for the latest model, or if the neighbor's latest purchase pressures you to go out and buy something as good as or better, then you are wrapping your life up in what you have. So anytime you think your life would be better if you owned something, if I only had that, then you're believing the lie of covetousness. You're believing that who you are, is defined by what you possessed. Covetousness also says you can gain peace and rest by gaining possessions. Down in verse 19, the man's first statement to himself was, take your ease. It literally, it's just rest. We might say, be at ease. Notice he's talking, verse 19, to his soul. This is not, I'm physically tired, prop my feet up, rest a little bit. I've had a long day, I'm going to bed early, or I'm going to sleep in tomorrow, that kind of thing. He's speaking to his soul. And he says to his soul, be at ease. You have all of this. You can rest now. Peace is tied into what is owned. Covetousness says you can find security by having enough of, by having more of, by having this thing. And this rich man believed the lie of greed. But again, his ancient sentiment here, this idea that if I have enough, I can be at peace, that is completely modern. We find that all around us. We bump into it probably half the time we look in the mirror. We bump into it all the time. This idea that I just need more and then I can be at rest. So some imagine a certain quantity of guns and ammunition will bring them peace. Some imagine if they have the house or the location, they will be at peace. Some imagine they have the relationship. The spouse, they will be at peace. Some imagine they have an apartment where they never have to do maintenance again. And then they can be at peace. And all of these things, all of this connects your peace, your security, your inner well-being, your inner rest to what is owned. And that is the lie of covetousness. And covetousness also says your soul will find delight in things. He says again to his soul, be merry, rejoice. Soul, find joy in life, find delight and happiness. He's not, again, speaking of temporal things, of secondary things. He's not speaking of a partial delight or joy or peace or identity. He's speaking of in an ultimate sense that these things will truly bring life, peace, and joy to his soul. He's seeking true joy in his possessions. And again, many today still think that they can find delight for their soul in physical goods. And yet we know it's obvious on the face of it that possessions bring nothing more than a fleeting happiness. How long is it after you open the package that your newest gadget begins to lose its greatness? How long is it until you start noticing the problems or you start complaining about some design or feature in it? How long until you're anticipating the latest version, waiting for it to come out? All the happiness that you find in the new thing quickly wears out. And if you ever think, if I had this, I'd be happy, then you have begun to believe the lie of greed. If you're dissatisfied and discontent with your life because of what you do not have, then you have been duped by covetousness. If you constantly have to buy the latest of something, then you're covetousness. If you have to have something else, it's just that simple. If you have to have something else to be happy, you are believing the lies of greed. And yet we know it never lasts. UPS is going to bring you 3 boxes of happiness tomorrow. But you will have to have 2 more deliveries before the weekend because that happiness just doesn't last. And no matter how many smiles they put on the outside of the box, happiness never comes in cardboard boxes. We know this. I'm not stating anything we've not thought about before, heard before. But we still fall into this trap and we begin to look for ultimate meaning in temporary things. Now, I do not mean that things don't bring us any happiness or don't give us any sense of security or don't even give us any sense of who we are. There absolutely is a sense where our possessions do give us, for example, happiness. There is a sense of peace when we know that we have a good retirement account and their investments are going up instead of down. There is a peace that is present. And I'm not saying that that is a sinful peace. Because in fact, as we go through scriptures, we recognize that God uses those things to give us a measure of happiness or peace or comfort or whatever it may be. And they are fine as long as they are the mediaries. And we recognize that they're secondary. They're not ultimate. That it is not my investments that gives peace, but it is God who gives peace. And he may have graciously allowed successful investments, but he is the ultimate one. And ultimately, that Jesus does not condemn this rich man because he had a lot. God condemned the rich man because he did not think rightly about his possessions. The final thing, verse 21, Jesus says to him, as he speaks of being rich toward God, so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. So you have a choice. Lay up treasures for self or be rich toward God. What could this rich man have done to avoid the rebuke and judgment? I think it's really very simple. He could have planned with God in mind. He could have been generous with his goods. He could have sought rest and rejoicing in God, not his possessions. I think ultimately what it would come down to is he could have seen his goods as a stewardship given to him by God for the service of God, for the increase of the kingdom of God. He could have planned well for his life and planned well for eternity. And that's where he fell down. That's where the problem lies. He only planned for this life. And ultimately, this kind of perspective is one that trusts the faithfulness of God. It is one that recognizes the greatness of his kingdom. It realizes the stewardship of our possessions so that every one of us, if we are going to be rich toward God, we cannot treat our possessions as our own. We must see them as divine assets entrusted to you and I for the increase of the kingdom of God. We do not view those things as existing to bring us comfort, to make our life easier necessarily, but for the increase of the work of the Lord. It is the covetousness one who sees his possessions as his own, and he views them as necessary for his life. The one who is rich toward God sees his life and his possessions as God's, loaned to him to be used for the increase of the kingdom of God. I'm out of time, and I want to just make one comment here, though. As you're thinking about the application of this, I know we have a lot of retirees here, and we have some who are approaching retirement and thinking longingly of it. This parable should shape the way you think about retirement. Because what this man said is exactly the way the majority of Americans, and I think the majority of American Christians, view retirement. It is the time to do what I want, to be at ease and to just simply be merry in my plans for my life. And if we're going to rightly apply this parable, we need to bring ministry back in. And I would challenge you, as you're thinking about retirement, whether you're enjoying it now or looking to it in the future, think about how you use retirement for ministry, how you can take that extra time that I know none of you retirees actually have, Hey, you can use that extra time for service, to minister to someone. There's needs in this church and in this community that can be met simply by time and compassion. You have skills that you've labored your life to build. And some of them you can immediately apply into ministry to others. Think about how you may use your retirement for eternal good. So you do want to know ultimately how you can be certain of enjoying the things that God has given you? Invest them in heaven. Somebody has wisely said, you can't take it with you, but you can send it ahead. Pastor C.T. Studd said very memorably, only one life will soon be passed. Only what's done for Christ will last. So what are you doing with your life?